Okay, brethren. Well, good morning to those of you who've joined us in the USA, and a good afternoon to the big crowd here in the UK. I speak in jest. Today, we're going to begin a Bible study of the book of Habakkuk, or if you prefer, Habakkuk, but I think the preferred pronunciation is Habakkuk. And I think prophecy, for many of us, has always been of great interest. I know personally, it was prophecy that first attracted my attention to the Church of God. I'm going way back to the 1960s, when in those days, Mr. Garner Ted Armstrong was the voice of the World Tomorrow broadcast here in Britain. And every day, virtually, it seems, Mr. Ted Armstrong would be proclaiming and preaching about prophecy, about dramatic events to take place in the very next few years, about the risk of nuclear war, Holocaust destruction, and frankly, it was scary stuff. And I think my response to the message was one of near panic. I don't want to go through all this trouble. I don't want to be in the Third World War in a concentration camp in Germany. So it was very much a question of I felt strongly motivated to understand what was coming next, so as to protect my skin and escape from it if I possibly could. And of course, we are now actually much nearer the end than when I first started hearing the message, and probably the same for you good selves. But when we look at prophecy, of course, I think we're all aware that there tends to be a great deal of speculation in prophecy. Prophecy is talking about things which have not yet occurred, things that are in the future, 2 years away, or 5 years away, or 20 years away. How can we tell? And so people very often start to paint pictures of events and circumstances and situations and people which have not yet occurred. And that does lead to a certain amount of speculation. And to be blunt, much speculation has been in error. And yet, the prophecies in the Bible are there for a reason. Mr. Armstrong said that one third of the Bible was prophecy. You know, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Hosea, and so on, including, of course, Habakkuk. And we know that all Scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable. That means it's of benefit to us. It means that the one-third of the Bible, which is prophecy, is useful for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, and for instruction in righteousness. So therefore, it would not be proper for us to ignore one-third of the Bible. And yet, when we do come to study prophecy, I think we have to realize that prophecy is somewhat complex. There are shades of meaning and understanding, and probably prophecy is best understood after it has occurred, because then you can see more clearly what it all meant. When you're looking at prophecy from before it happens, sometimes you do get things a little bit wrong. So as we approach the book of Habakkuk, there's really two things I would like us to look for, two sort of basic principles I think we should try to establish. One is, welcome if you join the conference, one is that we should understand in any book of prophecy the basic outline. What does the book actually say? Not necessarily what will happen and what does it mean in detail, but what is the basic outline of the book? Because if we understand the basic structure of the prophecies, then when they do come to pass, we'll see them much more clearly and understand much more quickly what's then happening before our eyes. For example, if somebody said at the moment to you, give me a brief rundown on the book of Nahum, or talk me through just briefly the outline of the book of Micah, could you and I do that? Or are those books completely anonymous to us? We've no idea how many chapters, what the main characters are, what is said to happen. Well, that's where hopefully, point number one, looking at Habakkuk, we will come to understand the basic structure of the book. And the second principle is, let's look for lessons in Habakkuk that you and I can use today. Because if the prophecy of Habakkuk is for a few years from now, or 18 months from now, I'm not too sure, then it's what we do today with that information which is going to be important to us. So the two things we hope to get out of our study of Habakkuk are to understand at least the basic outline of the book, the main parts of it, and secondly, what principles of living can we take from the prophecy that we can apply today and tomorrow. Okay, that's a long-winded introduction over, so now we'll begin. If you find the book of Habakkuk in your Bibles at chapter 1, if you're struggling a bit, I can tell you it's page 935. Well, if using my Bible, it's page 935. Okay, Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 1. And in chapter 1, we'll find two parts. Habakkuk asks God a very deep question. So the first part of Habakkuk 1 is really question number 1. And then God gives Habakkuk an answer. And we'll call that answer number 1, because we're very mathematical. And then Habakkuk is not satisfied, so he asks question number 2, to which God gives answer number 2. And that takes us through chapters 1 and 2. So basically, we'll start off now with the first question of Habakkuk, question number 1. Verse 1, the burden which the prophet Habakkuk saw. And here it is. O Eternal, how long shall I cry and you will not hear? Even cry out to you violence and you will not save. Habakkuk is frankly a little bit exasperated with the Creator God, because he's going to God, he has some major concerns, and yet it does seem that God's ignoring his prayer, ignoring his complaint. How long shall I cry to you, God? And you're doing nothing. You're not listening to me. I'm crying out to you about the desperate situations that I can see. I'm talking about violence in the midst, and you will not save. I can't understand this, God. Verse 3, why do you show me iniquity and cause me to see trouble or toil? For plundering and violence are before me. There is strife and contention arises. You know, everywhere that Habakkuk would look, there seemed to be problems and trouble and difficulties, and Habakkuk was very much concerned over those. So he was doing, you might think, the right thing. He was taking these problems to the Creator God and had been doing so for some time, and yet, amazingly, God was doing absolutely nothing. Habakkuk was perplexed. What kind of God could this be that would ignore all these problems? Verse 4, therefore the law is powerless and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous, therefore perverse judgment proceeds. So Habakkuk is very specific here. He says, look, God, in our country, in this land of ours, frankly, the law is not worth anything. The law has no power. It is impotent. The laws might be there, but nobody actually lives by them. Whether it's the laws of God, whether it's the laws of society, civil laws, criminal laws, people get away with murder, literally. And there's no justice in the world. There's no justice here in Britain, says Habakkuk. There's no justice here in these fine United States, says Habakkuk. For what's going on, God? For the wicked, they outnumber the few righteous. And frankly, even the justices and the judges, they're corrupt. The judgment you get when you go to court, it's hardly worth having. And I can't understand, says Habakkuk, why all this trouble, and frankly, God, you are doing nothing. What's happening? And so I think, looking at those first few verses, we get an impression of Habakkuk the prophet. He is a man who is very much affected by what he sees around him, and he is genuinely extremely upset over what he sees. Whether it's looking at his world that he lives in, and Habakkuk lived in, frankly, rather a difficult time. The book of Habakkuk appears to have been written round about 605, 610 BC. This was a time when in Habakkuk's days there was a great wars and rumors of wars in his country. The major empire of Assyria, which had ruled for a century or more, had recently been defeated by the Babylonian Empire. And I think we know of Nebuchadnezzar, one of the top emperors, generals, kings of Babylon. And there have been wars between Assyria, Babylon, and Egypt. And Jerusalem had been threatened a number of times. So poor old Habakkuk was living in a really quite a sort of hair-raising time, with nations going to war against nations and the threat of invasion hanging over the country, not dissimilar to perhaps living in the 1930s in Europe. So a very difficult and troubling time. And Habakkuk was very aware that internally, among his country, and among, you might say, even the congregation of God, that things were far from right. And he was deeply, deeply concerned. God's people were not doing things properly. There was perverseness among the people of God, among the country. And I think you and I can imagine, looking around our countries, that I think we would admit there's a great deal that's wrong in Britain and America in the way our countries operate. Let's better put a ribbon or a piece of card or a $100 bill in chapter 1 of Habakkuk, because we're going to bounce backwards and forwards. We're going to go back, first of all, to the book of Micah. That's going back towards Genesis, just a couple of books. So back towards Nahum and into Micah. And read chapter 3. When we get there, verses 19. Chapter 3 of Micah. Starting in verse 9. Micah 3, verse 9. And we're going to look at what the prophet says about his country, God's people, Israel. Now hear this, you heads of the house of Jacob, and rulers of the house of Israel, who abhor justice and pervert or twist all equity. There's no fairness. The rulers, the governors, justices, the politicians, the country's leaders, they pervert what is fair and true, who build up Zion with bloodshed and Jerusalem with iniquity. Her heads judge for a bribe. Does that happen in our countries? Is it remotely possible that the leaders in industry, in commerce, in education, in, dare we say, politics, get judgments made on the basis of money and bribes and so on? Her priests teach for pay, and her prophets divine for money. There's the religious element, people saying things and teaching things, not because it's what God says, but because there's some financial benefits. Yet they lean on the Eternal and say, is not the Eternal among us? No harm can come upon us. And that will turn out to be one of the most stupid statements they would make. Denial, because they somehow think, because they quote the name of Jesus Christ, that somehow they'll be protected. And as we'll see going through Habakkuk, that was a major flaw. Therefore, verse 12, because of you, Zion shall be plowed like a field. Jerusalem shall become heaps of ruins, and the mountain of the temple like the bare hills of the forest. So Micah prophesies that the beauty of Jerusalem, this fantastic temple of Solomon and so on, is going to end up just a big heap of ruins. And why? Because, as it says there in verses 9 and 10, the whole governing structure of Israel, of Judah, is perverse and corrupt. So let's turn to Isaiah chapter 1, book of Isaiah chapter 1. Isaiah chapter 1. And starting in verse 2. Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Eternal has spoken. I, says Eternal, have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me. The ox knows its owner, and the donkey its master's crib. Even animals know the source of their, you know, food and drink. But Israel does not know. My people do not consider. And I think we'll see as we go through Habakkuk and these prophecies here, that you can sort of mix and match somewhat God speaking to Israel, the nation. But you can see hints of a warning here to God's people, spiritual Israel. Alas, sinful nation, verse 4. This is God speaking. Again, it will become clear as we go through Habakkuk, but you know, God's view of the United States, God's view of Scotland and England and Wales is perhaps a wee bit different from our view. We tend, unfortunately, to be very complacent about our standards. God doesn't look at our nations quite the way we do. God does not like dishonesty and unfairness and lying and adultery and stealing and cheating and idolatry. God does more than not like it. God loathes it. But to us, we can get a wee bit comfortable with it's just ordinary day-to-day life, isn't it? Well, verse 4, alas, sinful nation, a people laden, it says, or heavy with iniquity, a brood of evildoers, children who are corruptors. Well, that sounds like a pretty damning indictment upon the people of Israel. They have forsaken the Eternal. They have provoked to anger the Holy One of Israel. They have turned away backward. And that certainly could apply more accurately to the people of God, because you can't really forsake or turn away unless you were going God's way in the first place. Why should you be stricken again? You will revolt more and more. That's why you'll be stricken again, because you won't stop revolting. The whole head is sick, and the whole heart faints. From the sole of the foot, even to the head, there is no soundness in it, but wounds and bruises and putrefying, stinking, decaying sores. They have not been closed or bound up or soothed with ointment. You know, God looks at our country, our peoples, and he just thinks, what a disgusting mess they are. They are heavy, you know, bowed down and laden with sins and iniquities. Their whole government system, their family system, their social system is just rotten, like a bruised and putrefying. It doesn't impress God in the slightest. Look across at verse 21, same chapter, Isaiah chapter 1, verse 21. How the faithful city has become a harlot. It was full of justice, righteousness lodged in it, but now murderers. You know, if you look back in time, there were certain times when the USA, Britain, had a somewhat higher standards than you'll find today. You know, the US Constitution, for example, has much good in it. But nowadays, so much has decayed. Your silver has become dross. Your wine mixed with water. Your princes are rebellious and companions of thieves. Everyone loves bribes and follows after rewards. They do not defend the fatherless, nor does the cause of the widow come before them. Now, if you read that, what do you and I make of it? Does that sound like a nation that should stand proud of its behavior, its conduct? Your princes are rebellious. You know, your leaders, your politicians, your government officials are rebellious. They are companions of thieves. One would hate to mention a recent former president of the United States, but there's an individual that you'd have to say was a rebellious individual, and certainly appears to have been a companion of thieves and one who loved bribes. That's the nation we find ourselves in. If we turn back to verse 7, we can see one of the consequences that will come in the prophecy of Isaiah chapter 1, verse 7. Your country is desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. Strangers devour your land in your presence, and it is desolate as overthrown by strangers. So the prophecy makes it clear that because of the disgraceful conduct, behavior, attitude, standards, values of our nations, that destruction is coming. Verse 8. So the daughter of Zion is left as a booth in a vineyard, as a hut in a garden of cucumbers. Instead of being a beautiful city, you know, those skyscrapers, those great towers, the beautiful temple in Solomon's day, all these wonderful structures will end up like a little garden shed. Unless the Lord of hosts, verse 9, had left to us a very small remnant, we would have become like Sodom. We would have become or been made like Gomorrah. So God will leave a small remnant, but quite clearly, destruction is coming. Now, if you saw the state of Britain and America as God sees them, if you look around and see the problems as God sees them, if you realize the destruction that's coming, then of course you would be, like Habakkuk, very deeply upset. Let's turn to Ezekiel chapter 8. Ezekiel chapter 8. Ezekiel chapter 8, starting in verse 6. Because Ezekiel was another prophet of God who was very much made aware of what Israel and Judah and the people of God looked like to God. Verse 6. Furthermore, he, as God said to me, Son of man, do you see what they are doing? The great abominations that the house of Israel commits here, to make me go far away from my sanctuary. You know, God actually leaves his own sanctuary because he just cannot tolerate being there any longer because of the disgraceful behavior of these people. Now turn again, you will see greater abominations. If you thought that was bad, Ezekiel, come and see this. Verse 7. So he brought me to the door of the court. That was part of the temple area. And when I looked, there was a hole in the wall. Then he said to me, Son of man, dig into the wall. And when I dug into the wall, there was a door. And he said to me, go in and see the wicked abominations which they are doing there. So here, if you like, out of sight, out of public view, something was taking place. Verse 10. So I went in and saw, and there every sort of creeping thing, abominable beasts, and all the idols of the house of Israel portrayed all around on the walls. I mean, disgraceful. Drop down to verse 13. And God said to me, turn again and you will see greater abominations that they are doing. It gets even worse, Ezekiel. Look at this. Verse 14. So he brought me to the door of the north gate of the Eternal's house, you know, Eternal's temple, God's temple, and to my dismay, and this upset Ezekiel, women were sitting there weeping for Tammuz. You know, paganism, pagan worship in the temple of God. Ezekiel was astonished. God was disgusted. But it hasn't stopped even yet. Drop across to we'll keep on going. Verse 15. Then he said to me, have you seen this, O son of man? Turn again, you will see greater abominations than these. I mean, God's piling on the evidence for Ezekiel. So he brought me into the inner court of the Eternal's house. This is really getting deep into the worship of God, you would think. But there at the door of the temple of the Eternal, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 men with their backs toward the temple of the Eternal and their faces toward the east. And they, in God's temple area, were worshipping the sun toward the east. I mean, this really gets pretty insulting to God. You know, here were men in the inner court and they turned their back to God's sanctuary area and they were worshipping the rising sun toward the east. Verse 17. Then he said to me, have you seen this, O son of man? Is it a trivial thing to the house of Judah to commit the abominations which they commit here? I mean, they thought it was. Don't forget, you know, the Jewish leaders, they thought they were pretty good. They thought they were doing fine. Just like many of God's people today might think they are doing fine. Certainly the leaders of America and Britain probably think they're not doing too badly. Another election coming along. If I can just convince enough people to vote for me, we've got another 4 years, and then we can bring in all these new reforms because the country needs the Democrats. The country needs the Republicans. The country needs the Labour Party. People in power always seem to think that they're doing things fine because all the ways of a man are clean in his own eyes. Verse 17. For they have filled the land with violence. Violence, remember, that's what Habakkuk cried out. How long, Eternal, do I cry out to you of violence and you do nothing? Then they have returned to provoke me to anger. Indeed, they put the branch to the nose. They're thumbing their nose at God. It is an absolute, downright insult. And who could most insult God but, of course, God's own elect? Verse 18, therefore, says God, I also will act in fury. My eye will not spare, nor will I have pity. And though they cry in my ears with a loud voice, I will not hear them. There's a threat building up here, which, of course, the Eternal God will carry out. And when we get back to Habakkuk in a few moments, we'll see it being carried out. But the threat is here, carrying on to chapter 9, verse 1. Remember, Habakkuk was crying out to God. He was sighing and crying because of all the abominations he saw. That's what Habakkuk started off. Question number 1, chapter 9, verse 1. Then he called out in my hearing with a loud voice, saying, let those who have charge over the city of Jerusalem draw near, each with a deadly weapon or a big destroying axe in his hand. And suddenly 6 men came from the direction of the upper gate, which faces north, each with his battle axe in his hand. So here's some angels, and they are bringing, on God's instructions, battle axes, obviously, to battle. One man among them was clothed with linen and had a writer's inkhorn at his side. So he had a pen and ink handy. They went in and stood beside the bronze altar, which of course would be in God's temple. Now the glory of the God of Israel had gone up from the cherub where it had been to the threshold of the temple, and he called to the man clothed with linen who had the writer's inkhorn at his side, and the Lord said to him, go through the midst of the city, where? Through the midst of Jerusalem, where Habakkuk was, and put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and cry over all the abominations that are done within it. And of course, Habakkuk really was such a man. He was sighing, he was crying, he was perplexed, he couldn't understand why God was doing nothing but all these problems. To the others, he said, my hearing, go after him through the city and kill. Do not let your eye spare, nor have any pity. And you might think, as I would think naturally, this does not sound very good. This does not sound like you want to be at the wrong end of this particular commandment, because this is Jehovah God, the one who became Jesus Christ, saying to these angels, take your battle axes and go out there and start destroying and show no pity. You think, why would God ever take such action? I mean, why would God do this? And we'll find out that was in fact Habakkuk's second question. Verse 6, utterly slay old and young men, maidens and little children and women. This is God's instruction. But do not come near anyone on whom is the mark. And begin at my sanctuary, the very people of God. So they began with the elders, who were before the temple. Then he said to them, defile the temple and fill the courts with the slain. Go out. And they went out and killed in the city. I mean, that was quite astonishing. But I think we can perhaps start to just catch on to a little problem here. You know, when God looks at our behavior, and God looks at Britain and America, he doesn't tolerate the evil that you and I tend to take for granted and almost dismiss as being, well, it's just ordinary behavior, that. I mean, God wouldn't be too upset, would he? Just by people being people. I mean, most people are fairly good. They go to church on a Sunday morning, and they go to Bible study on a Wednesday night, and most people are fairly decent, aren't they? Well, yes, to us humanly, it may well look like that. But God's standards are somewhat different, and God does not like, and he's not going to totally tolerate, the abominations that he sees in our midst, because ultimately, if people are left to go as far as they can go, they will destroy themselves, corrupt themselves, and utterly pervert themselves, and God will not tolerate that. You know, so Habakkuk was looking around at these evils and troubles, and he was sighing and crying and thinking, you know, when is God going to do something? And really, in a sense, Habakkuk was displaying a certain lack of faith in his God. Turn to Luke chapter 18, and starting in verse 1, into the New Testament, book of Luke, chapter 18. Verse 1, this is Jesus giving a parable, which we'll just touch on very briefly. But Luke 18, verse 1, then he, Jesus, spoke a parable to them that men always ought to pray and not lose heart. Oh, I wonder if Habakkuk was just starting to lose heart slightly. He had been praying, remember? He'd been crying out to God, when are you going to do something? How long have I got to tell you about these problems? I'm talking to you about the violence and the law being slacked and you're doing absolutely nothing. What's the matter, God? Have you got a problem up there? Are you deaf? So Habakkuk is certainly starting to lose his patience, that God's doing absolutely nothing. But like Jesus said here, you ought always to pray and not lose heart, dropping down to verse 7. And shall not God avenge his own elect, who cry out day and night to him, though he bears long with them? The answer is, God will do that. I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. You know, you can cry out to God, as hopefully you and I are doing, about what we see in our midst and in our countries, about the abominations. You could think of abortions, for example. There's an abomination. You know, the medical authorities, the government system, the law of the land permits, approves the murder of unborn babies by the hundreds of millions. And it's legal and approved and funded by taxes and so on. So we can cry out to God of the abominations in our midst. And it tells us here, verse 8, I tell you that God will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on the earth? Do people believe that God will so avenge? Do people believe that God, you know, will intervene and will deal with these problems? Or, like Habakkuk was, will they start to almost give up hope? Let's turn back to Habakkuk after that short diversion. Habakkuk chapter 1. If you got your $100 bill stuck in the page there.
Luckily, yeah.
So that was verses 2 to 4 when Habakkuk, looking around at the appalling state of his country, and particularly the way the law was being dismissed and abused, cries out to God, why are you doing nothing? And really, in a sense, Habakkuk was displaying his own ignorance, because God was and is today doing something. You and I might not see it. Habakkuk clearly didn't see it, but God was nonetheless active and busy. And so that was question 1 from Habakkuk. Answer 1 from God begins with verse 5. This is answer number 1. And he responds to Habakkuk, look, Habakkuk, among the nations, and watch. Be utterly astounded. For I will work a work in your days which you would not believe, though it were told you. For indeed, I am raising up the Chaldeans, a bitter and hasty nation which marches through the breadth of the earth to possess dwelling places that are not theirs. So God starts to deal with Habakkuk and says, oh, so you think I'm doing nothing, do you, Habakkuk? Well, let me tell you something. You won't believe what's going to happen in just a few years' time. Look among the nations, verse 5, and be utterly astounded, for I will work a work in your days which you would not believe, though it were told you. Now in the Hebrew, it says where you would not believe, it's in the plural. It means really Habakkuk and your fellows, you plural, would not believe this even though it's told you. It's going to seem difficult to understand. It's going to be hard to accept. It is going to be unbelievable. And in a sense, that sort of raises another problem with Habakkuk, that really Habakkuk didn't have the faith that he ought to have had. Because if you have faith, then you will believe, and you will believe quickly. But God was saying, you know, you're not going to believe this, Habakkuk. It's going to seem impossible to you. You're not going to understand. You have a faith problem, really, Habakkuk. If we hold our place just for a moment and turn to chapter 2 of Habakkuk, and verse 4, we can read here, it says, verse 4, chapter 2, behold the proud, his soul is not upright in him, but the just shall live by his faith. The just, the righteous person shall live by his faith. And that particular verse gets quoted several other times in the Bible. But there is an issue here which God is dealing with, which is that people don't really believe that God's going to do what he says he's going to do. And there's many reasons why they don't believe that. But look at verse 5 again. Look among the nations and watch, be utterly astounded, for I will work a work in your days which you would not believe though it were told you. The Hebrew there brings in the fact that the particular work in question is going to be a work of destruction. Now we can check that out as we turn to Acts chapter 13. So again, hold your place there with your $100 bill. Acts chapter 13 and verse 41. Because Paul the Apostle quotes this verse, but adds a little bit of insight to it. Acts chapter 13 and verse 40. Beware therefore, says Paul, talking to the Jews in one of the synagogues, lest what has been spoken in the prophets come upon you. Verse 41, behold, you despisers, marvel and perish. For I work a work in your days, a work which you will by no means believe, though one were to declare it to you. So the Apostle Paul quotes Habakkuk 1:5, but notice he says, marvel and perish, because the particular work that's being described by God is a work of destruction and perishing. So back to Habakkuk. And verse 6, picking that up again, we can see what God is doing. He says, I, God, that's me, I'm raising up the Chaldeans. Now, who were the Chaldeans? Now, the Chaldeans is essentially the same as the Babylonians, the people of Babylon. We mentioned, I think, Nebuchadnezzar a few moments ago. And Nebuchadnezzar, who appeared, of course, in the book of Daniel, was also the head of gold of Daniel's image. And Nebuchadnezzar was a pretty powerful, pretty impressive individual. And he was the head of the Chaldean Empire. He was the head of Babylon. And the Chaldeans are the Babylonians. If we want to consider a modern fulfillment of this, it's probably worth knowing that the Chaldeans migrated from the original area they lived in Mesopotamia. And strangely enough, the Chaldeans ended up populating the area of Rome. And from around about 100, 200 BC to 200, 300 AD, the Latins, the Roman Empire in its heyday, was actually made up of Chaldeans. Dr. Ernest Martin used to write in the Plain Truth and the other Church of God literature way back in the 1950s and 60s, has written quite a long article showing that the Chaldeans ended up in Rome, and the Roman Empire was in fact the Chaldean Empire in essence. So since we expect, shall we say, a final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire with a great deal of influence and power and authority coming from the area of Rome, then it's worth recognizing that the Chaldeans are still there. So I am raising up the Chaldeans, a bitter and hasty nation, which marches through the breadth of the earth to possess dwelling places that are not theirs. They are terrible and dreadful. You know, God doesn't want to leave Habakkuk or his fellows in any illusions. He's using the nation of Babylon or Chaldea to carry out his work. And it's going to be a terribly destructive work. They are terrible and dreadful. Their judgment and their dignity proceed from themselves. They don't answer to anybody. You know, the Chaldeans, the future of beast power, because that's where the prophecy will be fulfilled in our day and age, they're not going to be responsible to the United Nations. They'll be talking about complying with the Geneva Convention on Human Rights and the conduct towards prisoners of war and civilians. It says their judgment and their dignity proceed from themselves. They'll decide how to crush a nation or a city or a peoples, and they'll do it their way. There won't be any question of any world standards or values that they will acknowledge. They'll do it themselves. Their horses also are swifter than leopards and more fierce than evening wolves. You know, their weaponry is going to be pretty destructive. You know, more fierce than evening wolves. I mean, wolves of the evening were wolves that had sort of fasted all day long. They were hungry. And as the sun went down and became dark and dangerous, these wolves would come out in packs and destroy and tear and rend. So he's saying, look, the Chaldean Empire, Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, or in our day, the modern beast power, will be like that, destructive, like evening wolves. Their chargers charge ahead. Their cavalry comes from afar. They fly as an eagle that hastens to eat. They're coming from a long distance to find prey to eat up and gobble up, and so on. They all come for violence. Their faces are set like the east wind. They gather captives like sand. They scoff at kings, and princes are scorned by them. I mean, these are arrogant, these people. You know, kings, they spit on them. They deride every stronghold, for they heap up mounds of earth and seize it. In olden days, if you wanted to attack a city like Jerusalem, and it was all walled all around about it, how did you do that? Simply, you just took your soldiers, and if it took you months, but you piled up the earth on a big ramp until you could actually go up the side of the walls and attack inside the cities. Then his mind changes and he transgresses. He commits offense, imputing this power to his God. So he ascribes his success and his victory in military matters and conquering and destroying to his own pagan God. And so, you know, God's first answer to Habakkuk is, Habakkuk, you're complaining about the abominations, the conduct, the behavior of your people, and saying, I'm doing nothing. You don't know about half of it, Habakkuk. Just watch. I'm going to raise up the Chaldean Empire, and they're going to come along, and they're going to destroy your country and leave nothing left virtually. And of course, that probably wasn't what Habakkuk wanted to hear. But God did use Nebuchadnezzar powerfully, and he did use Babylon powerfully to fulfill his desires. So we turn to Ezekiel chapter 30. Ezekiel chapter 30. And reading verses 24 and 25. Ezekiel 30, and starting in verse 24, God says, I will strengthen the arms of the king of Babylon, that's Chaldea, and put my sword, says God, in his hand. But I will break Pharaoh's arms, and he will groan before him with the groanings of a mortally wounded man. You know, God is against Egypt, but he's going to empower, powerfully, Babylon. Thus I will strengthen the arms of the king of Babylon, but the arms of Pharaoh shall fall down. They shall know that I am the Eternal when I put my sword into the hand of the king of Babylon, and he stretches it out against the land of Egypt. You know, here's God saying that I'm going to use Chaldea, Babylon, to destroy Egypt, to teach Egypt a lesson. You know, God is in complete control of all the nations. There's nothing that the terrorists can do. There's nothing that the Chinese can do, or the North Koreans, or the Saudis, or Eastern Europeans. God is in control. He's watching, and he's going to do things to fulfill his purpose. Ezekiel 29, one chapter earlier, and verses 18 and 20. Ezekiel 29, verses 18 through 20. Son of man, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, caused his army to labor strenuously against Tyre. Every head was made bald, and every shoulder rubbed raw. Yet neither he nor his army received wages from Tyre for the labor which they expended on it. You know, Nebuchadnezzar attacked the city of Tyre and actually besieged it, could you believe, for 13 years, trying to conquer Tyre. And that's where the every head made bald and shoulders rubbed raw. The soldiers had to have their helmets on to protect them, so day in, day out, for 13 years. There was no hair left. I guess these old tin helmets they had. And of course the shoulders carting all the rubble and boulders as they built, you know, these long jetties out to Tyre. But at the end of it, the people from Tyre put their wealth into boats and sailed off. So when Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon finally captured Tyre, there wasn't much, frankly, booty left for them. Verse 19, therefore thus says the Lord God, surely I will give the land of Egypt to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. That's what God said. I, God, I'm going to give Egypt to Babylon, to Nebuchadnezzar. He shall take away her wealth, carry off her spoil, and remove her pillage, and that will be the wages for his army. I have given him the land of Egypt for his labor, because, says God, they worked for me. So we can see that, you know, God has used Babylon deliberately to carry out his will, and God is going to use Babylon again to carry out his will. And that was something that, you know, that Habakkuk had to sort of realize. Return to Deuteronomy chapter 28. Deuteronomy chapter 28. And read verses 49 through 52. And while you're turning there, I'll just remind you of verse 8 of Habakkuk 1, where it says that that they fly as the eagle that hastens to eat, and the cavalry comes from afar. That's one of the descriptions of, you know, Babylon, Chaldean. Deuteronomy 28, which is the blessings and cursings passage, verse 49, talking of if Israel would not obey God's laws, they would reap curses. And of course, we've seen that, in fact, Israel and Judah were not obeying God's laws. Verse 49, the Eternal will bring a nation against you from afar, from the end of the earth, as swift as the eagle flies, a nation whose language you will not understand, a nation of fierce countenance, which does not respect the elderly, nor show favor to the young. So, you know, that's what something's going to happen to God's people. Turn to Isaiah chapter 5. Back to Isaiah chapter 5. And verses 24 through 30. You know, we have to accept that what Habakkuk heard from God was not good news in many ways. Equally, it's not, frankly, good news to us to see what is going to come to pass. Verse 24 of Isaiah 5, therefore, as the fire devours the stubble and the flame consumes the chaff, so their root will be as rottenness and their blossom will ascend like dust, because they have rejected the law of the Eternal of Hosts, and despise the word of the Holy One of Israel. Therefore, the anger of the Eternal is aroused against his people. He has stretched out his hand against them and stricken them, and the hills trembled. I mean, frankly, it's the worst possible news you could ever get, is that God's turned his hand against you, individually or as a nation. Their carcasses were as refuse in the midst of the streets. For all this, his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. He will lift up a banner to the nations from afar, and will whistle to them from the end of the earth. Surely they shall come with speed swiftly. Not one or no one will be weary or stumble among them. No one will slumber or sleep, nor will the belt on their loins be loosed, nor the strap of their sandals be broken. So these military nations are coming at breakneck speed, blitzkrieg style. On whom? On Israel and Judah, because of their abominations and iniquity, whose arrows are sharp and all their bows bent. Their horses' hooves will seem like flint, and their wheels like a whirlwind. Their roaring will be like a lion. They will roar like young lions. Yes, they will roar and lay hold of the prey. They will carry it away safely, and no one will deliver. In that day, they will roar against them like the roaring of the sea. And if one looks to the land, behold darkness and sorrow, and the light is darkened by the clouds. So an amazing time of destruction coming upon God's people. And of course Habakkuk is hearing this and probably getting worse and worse as he thinks through all the implications. You know, what? I mean, our people destroyed by the Babylonians? But they are cruel. You know, and hasty and vicious and destructive. I can't believe this. And of course, can't believe it is a problem with faith, because faith believes what God says. And as God said, you know, in verse 6 of Habakkuk 1 or verse 5, you won't believe this, even though it's told to you, you're not going to believe it, because you you will just think, no, God couldn't do this, not to Israel, not to United States, not to Great Britain. God couldn't really do that. I mean, we're not that bad a people, are we? Well, let's turn to Jeremiah chapter 5. Book of Jeremiah chapter 5. Jeremiah chapter 5 and read verses 11 through 17. For the house of Israel and the house of Judah have dealt very treacherously with me, says the Eternal. They have lied about the Eternal and said, it is not he, neither will evil come upon us, nor shall we see sword or famine. You know, they can't believe it. It's been told to them. But they say, oh, no, God would never do that, not to us. We will not see evil. We won't see sword or destruction or military invasion. We'll never experience famine. And the prophets become wind, for the word is not in them. Thus shall it be done to them. Therefore, thus says the Eternal God of hosts, verse 14, because you speak this word, behold, I will make my words in your mouth fire, and this people wood, and it shall devour them. Behold, I will bring a nation against you from afar, O house of Israel, says the Eternal. It is a mighty nation. It is an ancient nation, a nation whose language you do not know, nor can you understand what they say. Their quiver is like an open tomb. They are all mighty men, and they shall eat up your harvest and your bread, which your sons and daughters should eat. They shall eat up your flocks and your herds, your vines and fig trees. They shall destroy your fortified cities in which you trust with the sword. You know, destruction is coming. And though the people don't believe it, well, God will never do that to us. In God we trust. God says, I'm sorry, it will happen. Turn back to Jeremiah chapter 7. Jeremiah chapter 7. And we'll read verses 3 through 15. This again highlights that as a people, it'll be very hard for the Americans and the British people to believe that God will ever do this, because we are so confident as a nation, and sometimes even in the church, so confident that we are right and proper and decent and not too bad at the end of the day. But God's views are often very different. Verse 3, thus says the Eternal of hosts, the God of Israel, amend your ways and your doings, and I will cause you to dwell in this place. Do not trust in these lying words saying, the temple of the Eternal, the temple of the Eternal, the temple of the Eternal are these, because that's what they did then. They said, well, look at this fantastic temple of Solomon. Look at the beauty. It's been here. It was built by God's own design. God's behind this. It's his own work. There's no way anything could happen to us with God's temple here. And God says, those are lying words. Verse 5, for if you thoroughly amend your ways and your doings, if you thoroughly execute judgment between a man and his neighbor, if you do not oppress the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, and do not shed innocent blood in this place, or walk after other gods to your hurt, then I will cause you to dwell in this place, in the land that I gave to your fathers forever and ever. But we know already from Habakkuk's complaint that they were oppressing strangers and fathers. They were shedding blood. They were dishonest. Verse 8, behold, you trust in lying words that cannot profit. Will you steal, murder, commit adultery, swear falsely? Recognize any of that among the people of America or Britain? Burn incense to Baal, and walk after other gods whom you do not know, and then, you know, how impossible, then come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, and say, we are delivered to do all these abominations? Do you think you can stand in front of me and say that it's okay? Has this house, which is called by my name, become a den of thieves in your eyes? Behold, I, even I, have seen it, says the Eternal. Habakkuk thought God was blind, and he had to keep reminding God and complaining that God was doing nothing, but God was well aware. God knows what's taking place in the White House, in 10 Downing Street, in your house, in my house. But now, go to my place, which was in Shiloh, originally, where I set my name at the first, and see what I did to it, because of the wickedness of my people Israel. And the answer is it was destroyed, just a heap of stones and boulders and ruins by now. And now, because you've done all these works, says the Eternal, and I spoke to you, rising up early and speaking, but you did not hear, and I called you, but you did not answer, you did not believe what were told you, you did not have the faith, therefore I will do to this house, which is called by my name, in which you trust, and to this place which I gave to you and your fathers, as I have done to Shiloh, and I will cast you out of my sight. So the unthinkable not only can happen, the unthinkable to the people of Israel, even the people of God perhaps, will happen. God's word is true. It's fixed. It is sure. And Habakkuk asked the question, and frankly, God just jumped all over him and gave him an answer that was really quite terrifying. And did it happen? Well, turn to 2 Kings chapter 25 for a moment. 2 Kings chapter 25. And read verses 1 through 11. Two Kings 25, starting in verse 1. Now it came to pass in the ninth year of his reign, this is Zedekiah, in the tenth month, on the tenth day of the month, that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and that's whom Habakkuk was being warned about, and of course in our day it will be another one of these coming along, that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and all his army came against Jerusalem and encamped against it, and they built a siege wall against it all around. Now remember, the people said, oh, never happened to us. We're too good. We're God's own people. But don't forget, we're circumcised. We have a covenant, an eternal covenant. Don't forget, we've got Abraham as our father and King David. We've got the temple here, the beautiful temple with the Ark of the Covenant. Nothing can ever happen to us. But it did. So the city was besieged until the 11th year of King Zedekiah. By the ninth day of the fourth month, the famine, which they said could never happen, had become so severe in the city that there was no food for the people of the land. Then the city wall was broken through, and all the men of war, fled at night, by way of the gate between the two walls, which was by the king's garden, even though the Chaldeans, there they are, God said he'd raise them up, and he did, were still encamped all around against the city, and the king went by way of the plain. But the army of the Chaldeans pursued the king, and they overtook him in the plains of Jericho. All his army was scattered from him. So the pride and the arrogance of Judah was now found out, wasn't it? So they took the king and brought him up to the king of Babylon at Riblah, and they pronounced judgment on him. Then they killed the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes. Pretty horrific. Put out the eyes of Zedekiah, equally horrific, bound him with bronze fetters, and took him off to Babylon. Now in the fifth month, on the seventh day of the month, which was the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, a servant of the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem. He burned the house of the Eternal and the king's house. All the houses of Jerusalem, that is, all the houses of the great men, he burned with fire. Now just imagine being there at this time, that beautiful temple of Solomon that cost billions of dollars, the king's own palace, all the houses of the wealthy men, the arrogant individuals that sinned and perverted the law and perverted justice and scoffed and mocked at the prophets, just as fire raging throughout Jerusalem and even God's own temple, which the people trusted in, on fire. And all the army of the Chaldeans, who were with the captain of the guard, broke down the walls of Jerusalem all around. Then Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carried away captive the rest of the people who remained in the city, and the defectors who had deserted to the king of Babylon with the rest of the multitude. So Habakkuk was promised what was going to happen, and it happened. Okay, let's turn back now to Habakkuk chapter 1. We got as far as verse 11. So we've seen question number 1, which was, hey God, how come there's all this trouble in the land and you're doing nothing? And God says, whoops, hold on a moment, Habakkuk, you are an ignoramus, you do not have faith, you are not waiting patiently because I am doing a work that's going to knock your eyeballs out. And explained about the coming invasion and war and destruction, which of course latterly came. But this caused a problem to Habakkuk, which is his second question beginning in verse 12. So we've had question number 1 and answer number 1, now it's question number 2. Verse 12. Are you not from everlasting, O eternal, my God, my Holy One? The answer is obviously yes. We shall not die. O eternal, says Habakkuk, you have appointed them for judgment. And he's talking of the Chaldeans, or Babylonians, or we might say the beast power. You have appointed them for judgment. O rock, you have marked them for correction. I understand that, sort of. But then he says, verse 13, you are of purer eyes than to behold evil. You cannot look in wickedness. So now he's a bit perplexed again because God is a holy God. He can't look at evil things. He can't dwell with evil things. Why do you look on those who deal treacherously and hold your tongue when the wicked devours one more righteous than he? Habakkuk is now thinking, well, just a moment. You're not really going to allow this to happen because, I mean, Babylon's much worse than we are. How can you allow the wicked, in other words, Chaldea, to devour those who are more righteous than the Chaldeans? This makes no sense, God. You're too holy. I just can't see how you could allow this because you're not going to surely watch over and take part in and approve of and accept wicked people, destroying people who are better than they are. It's not godly, this. And he was perplexed again. Poor old Habakkuk, always struggling with what God's doing. Why do you make men like fish of the sea, like creeping things that have no ruler over them, meaning really the nation of Judah? Why are you going to make them like just fish in the ocean? Talking of what the Chaldeans will do, they take up all of them with a hook, they catch them in their net, and gather them in their dragnet. Therefore, they rejoice and are glad. The Chaldeans are going to dance and be happy and proud and arrogant because they're going to just fish our people going out to sea and throwing in the net and just dragging up all these little innocent fish. That's what they're going to do to our people. Therefore, they sacrifice to their net and burn incense to their dragnet because by them, by these tools, by this equipment, their share is sumptuous. It allows them to get more and more wealth. Their military might, their armies, their air force, their navy, they can capture what they want. They can take over any nation they want. And they're going to do that, God. And then they're going to sit back in wealth and abundance, and they're going to virtually worship their own military might. Shall they therefore empty their net and continue to slay nations without pity? I mean, Habakkuk is once again hopelessly confused. How can the great eternal God, who is holy and pure, allow a nasty bunch like the Babylonians to possibly punish the good people like his own people? It makes no sense. And are you going to allow these Babylonians to carry on just slaying nations, verse 17, without pity? I mean, this is... And so he's staggered again. Let's see why he was so staggered. If we turn to Psalms chapter 5, this is what was probably in the mind of Habakkuk. You can't understand why God would do it this way. Because Habakkuk, perhaps like you and I, probably thought he knew of a better way. Because, after all, I think God's not doing this quite the right way. I wouldn't do it this way if I was God. Psalms 5, starting in verse 4. For you are not a God who takes pleasure in wickedness, nor shall evil dwell with you. The boastful shall not stand in your sight. You hate all workers of iniquity. You shall destroy those who speak falsehood. The Eternal abhors the bloodthirsty and deceitful man. So therefore, if God hates wickedness and iniquity and bloodthirstiness, well, how could he possibly allow this to happen, you know, to good old Israel? And of course, the problem was that Israel wasn't good old Israel. Habakkuk had been a little bit, he'd been complaining initially of the sins of Judah and the way they perverted the law, but really he didn't realize quite how Israel looked to God. And God saw Israel as being disgusting, full of abominations, like a sort of decaying body full of wounds and bruises and putrefying sores. And so God hated the sins of Israel and Judah. Turn to Psalms 34. Psalms 34 and verse 16. The face of the Eternal is against those who do evil, to cut off the remembrance of them from the earth. Verse 21. Evil shall slay the wicked, and those who hate the righteous shall be condemned. And so Habakkuk is still puzzled. He's thinking, well, you know, God, you hate unrighteousness and you hate iniquity, and really, to send the Babylonians against us just seems so cruel and heartless and so on. But let's turn to Isaiah 55. Isaiah chapter 55. And we might have the same feeling. I mean, probably most of us have affection for our countries, a certain amount of patriotism, and we know many, many good people, decent people, honest people, and for us, we would not want to send the modern beast powers, the Chaldeans of today, against the people of Wisconsin or Texas or Tennessee or Missouri or England or Wales and so on. But you see, we don't have the same vision that God has. Isaiah 55 and verse 8, God says, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Eternal. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." The reality that we need to grasp is that, you know, God is in complete control of world events, and God does actually, surprisingly, know best. And Habakkuk, he was getting really tied in a knot here about why God would do all this nasty stuff to poor old Israel. I hadn't fully realized just how nasty Israel was in God's sight. And it wasn't that God thought Babylon was any better. God was going to use Babylon to punish Israel. And then, as we'll find out probably next week now in chapter 2, Babylon would get its comeuppance and be sorted out. You know, so, you know, Habakkuk thought, well, I know Israel may be bad, but it's not as bad as Babylon. Well, yes and no. Perhaps humanly it wasn't, but that's human reasoning. And as we just read there, God's ways are far above our ways. You know, we need to realize, and one of the basic principles we can learn from the book of Habakkuk, apart from the fact that God's in complete control, is that you know, you and I might be a little bit too casual sometimes with sin. I know that's hard to believe, but it's just a possibility we need to just hypothetically allow to ourselves that perhaps we don't have the same distaste for sin and transgressing God's law as God has of sin and people transgressing his perfect laws. We turn to Hebrews chapter 3. Hebrews chapter 3. Let's see if we can just learn a lesson for ourselves here. Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 12. This is just a very brief diversion, because clearly Habakkuk thought God was going over the top. It was just not right to use the Babylonians to do this dirty work. It was improper and unfair, and it just wasn't right, because he didn't realize, frankly, his own sinfulness, nor that of his people, as God saw it. Verse 12, Hebrews 3, "Beware, brethren," that's talking to you therefore, "and to me, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief," which, to be frank, Habakkuk suffered from, "in departing from the living God. But exhort one another daily, while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin." You see, sin is deceitful. It is so very easy for us as human beings to get comfortable with sin to the point where it's just a bad habit. Now, it's not sin. Gossip? Well, everybody gossips. Come on. Gossip's not a sin. It's just gossip. And everybody does it, don't they? And telling little white lies? Well, little white lies certainly aren't sin. And a bit sort of greedy? Well, yeah, having five helpings of chocolate pie isn't really a lack of self-control. I've just got a sweet tooth. And so sin, unfortunately, is deceitful. It deceives us. We don't see it the way God sees it, and that's a problem. Habakkuk certainly didn't see it quite the way God saw it. Let's turn to James chapter 1, just the next book. That's right, yep, Hebrews and James chapter 1, starting in verse 13. James chapter 1, verse 13. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. But each one, that's you and me again, is tempted when he or she is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. We are drawn away from the path of righteousness by our own desires and enticed. Then, when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, if you don't eradicate it, and if you pander to it, and if you pour water on it and let the sun shine on it, sin, when it's full grown, brings forth death. Now, God knows that. That's why God does not want us to sin, because it brings forth death. Verse 16, do not be deceived, my beloved brethren. Because, frankly, if we play with sin and harbor sin, it is deceptive. Be not deceived, and you will be deceived, and I will be deceived if we harbor sin in our midst. Turn to 2 Peter chapter 3. We might make this our last verse for today. 2 Peter chapter 3, starting in verse 11. Therefore, well, let's just back up a little bit. Verse 1. Beloved, I now write you the second epistle, in both of which I stir up your pure minds by way of reminder, that you may be mindful of the words which were spoken before by the holy prophets, such as Habakkuk, and of the commandment of us, the apostles of the Lord and Savior, knowing us first that scoffers will come in the last days. Scoffers will come in the last days, walking according to their own lusts and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. You know, in the last days, there will be people who lack their faith. They do not believe that God will come. They don't believe that the prophecies that we've studied over the years will actually come to pass. It's all historic. It took place centuries and thousands of years ago. And so in the last days, even in and among the people of God, there will be scoffers. Like Habakkuk, they will lack their faith. For this they willfully forget, that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of the water and in the water, by which the world that then existed perished, being flooded with water. Verse 9, the Lord is not slack concerning his promise or his prophecies, as some count slackness, but is long-suffering toward us, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, to those not paying attention, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. So these things will happen, they are sure, and people scoffing will not halt it. Verse 11, therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being in fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. So we should be holy. We should be following and pursuing the way of godliness, the path of righteousness. Therefore, verse 14, beloved, looking forward to these things, be diligent to be found by him in peace, without spot and blameless, because we know what's coming, because we can read Habakkuk, because we know that God's promises and prophecies are sure and definite, because we know that God cannot tolerate for much longer the abominations, the iniquities and the sins of Britain and America and even those among his church who are careless, God will deal with these things, absolutely sure. And therefore, verse 14, we should be diligent to be spotless and blameless. Verse 17, you therefore, beloved, since you know these things beforehand, beware lest you also fall from your own steadfastness, being led away with the error of the wicked. And that's where the deceptiveness of sin comes in. If we become comfortable with sin, if we think, well, God's not really serious about these sins, I've got a weakness there and it's just a bad habit, it's not really, really sin, will we deceive ourselves? And we could be led away with the error of the wicked. But, says Peter, grow in the grace and knowledge of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. To him be the glory, both now and forever. Amen. So we're told there to make sure that we continue to move forward on the path of righteousness and to grow. Let's just return to Habakkuk 1 for a moment, just to complete the Bible study for today. We've gone about half as far as I thought we'd get. I had a nasty fear, couldn't quite get through chapter 2, which was my hope. But just to recap then, in Habakkuk chapter 1, question 1, Habakkuk asks God, why are you doing nothing when there's so much abomination and trouble in the land? Answer, number 1, Habakkuk, you don't know what you're talking about. I'm about to raise up the most dramatic invasion of your country you could ever imagine. I'm sending the Chaldeans to you. But they, don't be mistaken, they are a cruel, bitter and hasty nation, and they will destroy big time. Question number 2 from Habakkuk, well, how can that be possible? How could you, a holy and righteous God, possibly send such a nasty crowd as the Babylonians against our, after all, reasonably decent people? Of course, the answer was that, frankly, Israel wasn't as good as Habakkuk thought, and their sins were an abomination in God's sight. So Habakkuk has asked that question, and next week we will get to God's second reply and see how specifically God dealt with Habakkuk's accusation that how could you use people like Chaldea to punish our relatively good and decent country. Okay, that's it, brethren. We'll finish with chapter 1, and next week we'll get on with chapter 2, and we might even possibly maybe do chapter 3 as well. We'll see. That's next week.